Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
So I'll introduce our two speakers first. Henry Urges is chairman of Concept Economics and formerly an economist at the OECD. He was head of Structural Adjustment Unit at the OECD and a counsellor for structural policy. And he, as I said, is the author of Wrong Number, Resolving Australia's Telecommunications Impasse. Now, Henry Urges has worked for Telstra as well as other international telcos. But tonight, Mr. Urges is speaking at the invitation of the Sydney Institute in a strictly personal capacity. And our second speaker is Paul Fletcher, who's been a long-time associate member and supporter of the Sydney Institute, so it's good to see him here as a speaker. Paul is currently Principal Fletcher Group. He's a former senior Optus executive and a former advisor to the Honourable Richard Alston when Mr. Alston, or Senator Alston as he then was a communications minister. And as I mentioned, Paul's the author of Wired Brown Land. So both our speakers are going to speak for 15 minutes or thereabouts, and then we'll have questions and discussion and finish no later than 7 o'clock. So we lead off with Henry Urges. Many thanks for coming along.
Thank you very much. Coming to this brown, then much less wired land after a childhood in continental Europe, I was impressed not only by its sparse beauty, but also by the eccentricities of the locals. Central among these was a passion for sport, and what peculiar sports they seemed. It was called football, looked like little more than an excuse for senseless violence. As for sailing, which consisted of hanging off the side of a small boat buffeted by wind and sea, it truly merged the pleasures of solitary confinement with the chance of drowning. Clearly, these were people willing to take pointless risks. Finally, there was the pastime that seemed to combine the interminable with the incomprehensible, i.e. cricket. It is said of luxury yachts that if you have to ask how much one costs, you can't afford it. Equally with cricket, if you have to ask what the rules are, you won't understand them. A love of thickets of rules inviting endless argument, then resolved through the essentially arbitrary but seemingly highly respected decision of an umpire, was plainly another important ingredient of the local scene. That was several decades ago, but I'm struck by the role those features, confrontation for its own sake, pointless risk-taking, uneasily combined with thickets of rules and an undue respect for seemingly arbitrary authority, have played in Australia's telecommunications history since the start of the reform process in the 1980s. First, there are no debates, only brawls. Participants rarely show genuine respect for each other's views, bring serious evidence to the table, and resolve differences in the light of that evidence. Events like tonight's are very much the exception, not the rule. Second, as the participants brawl, Leviathan has tended to do its thing, often with little or no regard for credible analysis of any kind. And third, there is entrenched faith in the ability of umpires, operating under rules that give them great discretion, to make judgments that, rather than reflecting their own preferences, aspirations, and interests, will soar dispassionately above the fray. This combination does not make it easy to achieve happy outcomes. Its consequences have been aggravated by deficiencies in checks and balances. This is partly due to the weakness of civil society, and despite the sterling efforts of ventures such as the Sydney Institute, especially of effective centres of analysis that do not depend largely or completely on the state. Long ago, Frederick Eggleston lamented that there are no freestanding Australian intellectuals. Rather, he said, our intellectuals are, quote, almost entirely institutionalised, and as a consequence, are too often reluctant to speak truth to power. That reluctance is understandable, because power has a nasty habit of biting back. But it helps engender and perpetuate a situation in which there is too little rigorous scrutiny of crucial decisions. Policy centralization then compounds the problems. Australians often congratulate themselves on the wisdom of the Fathers of Federation in giving the Commonwealth complete control over telecommunications. This, it is claimed, allowed the incompatibilities that allegedly afflicted the development of the rail network to be avoided, although Canada and the United States, in which communications and transport powers were at least partially devolved, seem to have avoided those incompatibilities. But even if one concedes that view of history, and I would not, centralization exacts costs of its own. It not only reduces the scope for policy experimentation, but even more importantly, relaxes the constraints on bad policy, as the policy-making jurisdiction both has deep pockets and faces little threat of exit. And to make matters worse, it gives swing or veto players, such as the rural areas or Tasmania, the ability to exact inefficient side payments they neither merit nor in a more decentralized system could ever have hoped to obtain. The result of this toxic brew in telecommunications is a system that has been confused in its objectives and in its design, discretionary and at times capricious in its application, and has shown little ability to sustain efficient outcomes or to correct its own deficiencies. The seeds of that system in its current form were sown in the decision to create a regulated duopoly between the merged Telecom OTC and what later became Optus. That regulated duopoly, which I argued strongly against, including at the Sydney Institute, embodied a belief in a form of managed competition whose substance amounted from the start to little more than infant industry protection. The outcome confirmed what Australia's century-long experiment with protectionism already convincingly showed, that the infant, far from growing up into a self-sufficient and strapping youth, had every incentive to invest in preserving the protection for as long as possible, while the regulator, whose job was centrally tied up with supplying that protection, understandably showed no inclination to commit euthanasia. The legacy passed on to the new regime when the duopoly ended in 1997 was an expectation that the regulator would manage market outcomes in a form of social engineering that has failed exactly as often as it has been tried. The ACCC, which in 1997 took up the regulatory role with even greater discretionary powers than had been vested on its predecessor, Austel, showed little hesitation in continuing on the social engineering path. Two elements stand out in this respect. First, confronted with the crucial but difficult task of setting third-party access charges to Telstra's network, the ACCC chose a methodology that gave it the greatest discretion over the determination of those charges level. Second, having secured that discretion, the ACCC steeply reduced the level of the allowed access charges, slashing them at rates far greater than those observed in the United States, Canada, or the EU. Two consequences followed. First, economics may be an uncertain science, but one principle is clear. If you reduce the price of something, more of it will be consumed, and less will be consumed of its substitutes. In this case, the good that more was consumed of was access to Telstra's network by third parties, such as Optus. The substitute good, for which demand fell, was used by those third parties of networks of their own. This became ever more pronounced as access charges were cut further and further, with Optus, Transact, and other putative builders of alternative networks shifting ever more of their use from those alternative networks onto Telstra's. If Telstra's network was not a monopoly to begin with, this was a very fine way of making it one. Second, basic economics also shows that if you cut the price of a good, you reduce the incentive to invest in its production. Unsurprisingly, Telstra's willingness to renew its access network diminished as access charges came down and as the risks associated with committing further shareholder funds rose. Equally unsurprisingly, this brought howls of protest from those, not least country users, who felt that as far as telecommunications is concerned, they deserve nothing but the best, especially when the price is to be paid largely by others. One might have thought the situation could not last, but It could and did, essentially for three reasons. First, when carrots fail, there are always sticks to fall back on. As the Emperor Nero famously discovered from his pioneering efforts at price control, governments can regulate to compel supply at least for a while. And that is precisely what was done. Specifically, we had a proliferation of regulatory requirements that, under the guise of protecting service quality, obliged Telstra to invest or face draconian penalties. Unfortunately, the targets set for the mandated service levels were entirely arbitrary, and despite calls from the Productivity Commission, were never subjected to any form of cost-benefit analysis. Second, the remaining cracks in the firmament were tackled by throwing money at programs whose aim was to expand the reach of high-speed services. Disappointingly, no cost-benefits assessments were ever made of this spending. My own estimate is that some $2 billion was wasted, that is, outlaid on projects whose benefits fell materially short of their costs. Third, however misconceived the policy may have been, it found many supporters. The ACCC was one, and as a powerful advocate for its own cause, it secured both considerable legitimacy and a spectacular increase in funding. So too were the access seekers, who at least in the short run gained when access charges fell. As for consumers, the low access charges did permit growing diversity in supply, especially in metropolitan areas, and placed greater competitive pressure on Telstra, though, as exactly one would expect in the presence of inefficient entry, retail prices remained relatively high, and indeed declined no more rapidly than they had pre-liberalisation. In the meantime, the costs were being shifted onto poorly organised groups, including the unfortunate purchasers of Telstra shares, and the even less well-represented taxpayers and consumers of the future. Paradoxically, as this situation was playing itself out, reforms in the energy industry sought to address the very problems that were proving so harmful in telecommunications. Largely because the states had a strong interest in energy supplies, regulatory discretion was pared back, with the functions of setting policy, translating policy into clear and predictable rules, and then implementing those rules separated out of the ACCC and vested in distinct authorities. While very far from perfect, the resulting structure avoided the worst conflicts of interest that permeate the institutional arrangements in telecommunications. In contrast, in telecommunications, a detailed inquiry by the Productivity Commission, which recommended narrowing regulatory discretion, was unfortunately ignored. In fact, in its wake, what accountability there was in the regime was weakened further as part of the concessions the Commonwealth made to get the second tranche of Telstra's privatisation out the door. The result was a progressive deterioration in the situation, culminating in the highly publicised standoff of recent years. What then should have been done? Simply put, we should have addressed directly the disincentives the current arrangements create to efficient investment and pricing, and then allowed market forces to determine the scope and pace of network upgrading. My book lists a range of changes, mostly incremental to the current arrangements, that would have preserved existing competition while placing clearer, more predictable bounds on regulatory discretion, thus also encouraging investment in competing facilities. Once implemented, those changes would have allowed us to rely on private decision-making and risk-taking to take us forward. But whatever should or should not have been done may now seem of purely historical interest, for the government appears to have cut through the situation with its commitment to build, likely at high cost, a new National Broadband Network, or NBN. Whatever the merits of that decision, it marks a significant change and requires us, in considering the regulatory environment, to look forward rather than back. Let me suggest, however, that it makes it even more important to draw the lessons from the problems with the current arrangements and to ensure that those problems do not persist or recur. In doing so, we must also confront the new policy challenges that the NBN itself raises. Stressing once again that these views are very much my own, allow me to focus on a few elements that I believe to be of particular importance. First, it remains crucial to have a policy and regulatory framework that can provide incentives for efficient investment, be it by the entity responsible for the new network or by its competitors. This must, in my view, involve setting out clear principles in legislation for determining regulated prices, and particularly for permitting the recovery of costs prudently incurred, as compared to the confused, conflicting, and often vague statements of objectives on which the current legislation relies. Second, it needs to be recognized that there are substantial dangers in recreating a situation where there is a conflict of interest between the government's role as policymaker and regulator, on the one hand, and its role as owner of a major competitor, on the other. These dangers only increase the importance of securing far greater transparency and accountability in the regulatory process. There is, in this respect, considerable merit in separating the functions of determining and issuing policy guidance, translating policy into carefully specified rules, and actually applying those rules through regulation. Third, complex competition issues are raised by any structure that involves a joint venture between the industry's main participants, who then all rely on the wholesale services the joint venture provides. Such arrangements have, in other contexts, created scope for collusion, and even absent such collusion, can impose a uniformity of competitive conditions, underlying technologies and cost structures inimical to vigorous rivalry. Were such a joint venture approach adopted in the NBN, it would be important to limit any cooperation as strictly as possible and to maximize the ability of participants to differentiate the applications and services they provide. Fourth, there must remain full scope for networks that compete with the NBN. This requires close attention to principles of competitive neutrality. Alternatives to the new network, be it the cable, copper, or wireless, will have to contend with an entity that is publicly subsidized, with a risk of inefficient outcomes. This makes it crucial that any subsidy element be explicit and transparent, limited to areas where service would otherwise be commercially unviable and equally available to all competing providers. Fifth, if costs are to be minimized, the venture's governance structure will need to avoid the inefficiencies that have plagued other infrastructure joint ventures, such as the open access coal loaders on our eastern seaboard. Experience with those ventures highlights the dangers involved in granting disproportionate weight, or even worse, veto rights to minor players, who can benefit by cost shifting or by holding up other market participants. Sixth, and related, realism is required about the costs and benefits of vertical separation, i.e. of a wholesale-only network. In government, there are gains to the separation of powers, as Montesquieu pointed out more than 200 years ago. The opposite is generally true where building complex networks and operating them on a commercial basis is concerned. In the specific context, separation could raise costs both in the transition to a new network and in the longer term. Seventh and last, any new network must be careful not to entrench the geographical cross-subsidies and other pricing distortions that have bedeviled Australian telecommunications since the 1920s. Gareth Evans, as Minister for Transport and Communications, took the first steps to try to bring transparency to those cross-subsidies, allowing time to then bring them under control. The Howard government also sought to rely more heavily on budget funding than on distorting price controls. It is important that the moves that have been taken in the direction of unwinding cross-subsidies be preserved, and that we go forward in limiting and rendering explicit any subsidies for non-commercial operations. In short, the government's announcement does not cut the Gordian knot of our current predicament. Rather, it highlights the need to remove the current regulatory blockages in a way that can open the road both to entirely new networks and to their competitors, giving market forces the primary responsibility to determine ultimate outcomes. Failure to do so will merely compromise the efficiency of our telecommunications system, which is now so vital to Australia's prosperity and so central to our daily lives. There is, in other words, still everything to be done. In saying this, I am reminded, and I will close with this, of one of the first books I read about this country. In Hancock's Magnificent Australia, now sadly out of print, the great historian famously said it was a failing of democracies, and especially of Australian democracy, to constantly confuse ends and means, and to show too much reluctance to refuse favours, to count the costs, to discipline the policies they have launched. He went on, "The policies therefore yield diminishing returns, until they become a positive danger to the national purpose that called them into existence." Nowhere was this more marked, Hancock noted, than with public involvement in ventures such as rail, where Australian government was, quote, particularly slow to confess it has got into a bad business, for its mere entry creates vested interests which immediately express themselves in politics. So it constantly throws good money after bad and hopes that something will turn up. In this way, losses accumulate in a lump, and the crisis, when it comes, is prolonged and severe. Mutato nomine, de te favula narratur. In other words, in this name changed, is this the story of our telecommunications future foretold? The best hope of avoiding that fate is for the country to debate these issues in an open, serious, and serene way. I therefore congratulate both Paul Fletcher and the Sydney Institute for contributing to that all too rare process, and thank you for your attention.
Take Paul's seat. So we continue with our discussion, telecommunications, the way forward, and our second speaker being Paul Fletcher.
Well, thank you, Gerard. It's a great pleasure to be here. Like Henry, I'm a great admirer of the work of the Sydney Institute. It's a particular pleasure to follow Henry, who was really somebody who taught me much about telecommunications. To his disappointment, I've somewhat gone off the reservation since then. But nevertheless, it is true that, as he's described in the blurb for this program tonight, he is one of Australia's best-known microeconomists. And isn't it a great signifier of how Australia has changed that somebody could be advertised as one of Australia's best-known microeconomists? I venture to suggest that that was not a description that would have been common in public discourse when Henry arrived in Australia. Look, troublingly, there's much of what Henry had to say that I agree with, but I'm going to concentrate on the bits where there is dissent. And what I want to talk about tonight is really how we got to the point where the Rudd government made the announcement it did a couple of months ago, which was extraordinary in a number of respects. Firstly, to commit to a $43 billion project when they'd previously been talking about spending $4.7 billion. Secondly, to announce an intention to get into business in competition with the private sector when policy direction for the last 10 years has been to withdraw taxpayers' capital from this industry. And thirdly, to signal very substantial regulatory intervention directed at the incumbent. What drove this remarkable decision, and what does it imply for the future of telecoms and broadband policy in this country? In my view, the answers are to be found in looking at what's happened over the last 20 years, and particularly over the last 4 or 5 years. And I want to focus on three issues tonight. The first is just to briefly remind all of us of the objectives of telecommunications policy: to drive vigorous competition and in turn deliver better services, lower prices, and more innovation to consumers than would occur otherwise. And as we'll see, that objective has only been modestly successful in fixed line telecommunications. Secondly, the fact that Australia is facing a transition to a new broadband network which uses much more optical fibre and delivers much higher speeds, a transition that's occurring around the world and presents tricky public policy issues everywhere it is faced. And in Australia, that's been complicated by the fact that Telstra sought to use that development to insulate itself against further competition. And thirdly, I want to argue that the highest priority to driving competition is to structurally separate Telstra. In my view, this should be done regardless of when and how quickly the new national broadband network is built. So to turn to the first point, competition, there is one point that all participants in the debate agree on, I think, which is that a vigorous competitive market delivers the best results for consumers. And we can look at the results in the mobile market, which most agree is effectively competitive, where take-up has risen relentlessly since competition commenced in 92, where mobile penetration now exceeds 100% of the population. Prices have dropped steadily. There has been continuing innovation in services, first with analog amps, then GSM, then third generation mobile, as well as all kinds of value-added services and content and so on. And this has happened because we have a genuinely competitive market structure in mobile, with until recently 4 separate operators, each with their own network, and the largest player, Telstra, having a market share that's only just over 40%. By contrast, in fixed line, Telstra retains a share of over 70% in many products. And in my book, I argue that the root cause for this is that an error was made when competition was introduced in the early 90s, when the then Minister for Transport and Communications, Kim Beazley, chose to put together two large companies, Telecom and OTC. The competing model, of course, was the Keating argument that the two should be launched into competition as the nucleuses of new competitive operators. In view of the model that was adopted, the government correctly recognised that unless there was some regulatory support for the new entrant, it would fail. Therefore, it established an access regime. And the idea was that Optus, as the first competitor in the regulated duopoly, could build some bits of its network and then rent capacity over Telstra's network to fill in the gaps where it did not have network of its own. And the reason behind that, of course, was that were that not done, then the area of the market where Optus could compete, or whoever the competitor was, would have been much reduced. And that structure continued when full competition arrived in 97. Telstra has always hated the access regime. Here's what Phil Burgess had to say about it. If McDonald's has to go to a regulator before it goes into business and declare what it's going to do on its ovens, and Hungry Jack's comes across the street and says, I want to buy those fish sandwiches, by the way, at a discounted price, and by the way, I get the first batch, and I'm going to sell a lot of them, and if you want more, you've got to build another oven, and by the way, you build the oven at your own expense, and by the way, the cost of the air conditioning, the gas, and the electricity, and the lights, those don't go into the price. Imagine that somewhat faster, somewhat louder, and in an American accent, and you get the full impression. But look, there's a real serious question here, and Henry has alluded to it. If you believe in free markets, as I certainly do, why would you force a company like Telstra to rent access to its network to its competitors? And the argument, the answer is, I believe, that in fixed-line telecommunications, because the market is so dominated by one player, that you do not get the benefits of competition. And in the absence, therefore, of regulation, that dominant player could keep prices higher and quantities supplied lower than would be the case in a competitive market. In my book, I look at the arrival of consumer DSL as an excellent case study of this. Telstra introduced consumer DSL in the year 2000, but it managed the arrival very carefully because it wanted to wring as much profit as it could out of the previous technology, dial-up internet, where it had almost a million customers in 2001, before it allowed DSL to become a mass-market product. So it made sense for Telstra, for its own commercial purposes, to charge a much higher price for DSL than for dial-up internet. And therefore at launch, the monthly charge was $89 for a 512K service. 8 years later, a service three times as fast cost half as much. This was rational conduct for Telstra, but I argue a bad public policy outcome because it meant that broadband take-up was suppressed for several years. Indeed, by the end of 2003, over 3 years after Telstra launched the service, there were only 241,000 consumer DSL services in Australia. And so, as a consequence, Australia's broadband penetration was held back behind other countries in the OECD until there was significant competitive entry by Optus in particular in 2004, which led to prices dropping sharply and broadband growth rocketing, with services reaching 3.64 million by September 2006. Given these facts, it is astounding that Phil Burgess went around complaining about Australia's low broadband penetration. In my view, this is akin to Robert Mugabe complaining about Zimbabwe's high inflation. But I instance that as an example of the kind of market power that Telstra retains and the core of the public policy problem. And the evidence in the case of broadband is that broadband take-up was slowed because it suited Telstra's commercial interests, and it was not under sufficient competitive pressure to prevent that. The next issue, then, is the transition to next-generation networks or broadband fibre-based networks. Around the world, copper-based networks are being replaced with optical fibre networks, and this offers, obviously, many advantages to operators. The networks are more reliable, they cost less to run. For consumers, they also deliver much higher speeds. Today, the practical limit on ADSL 2 Plus is around 20 megabits per second if you happen to live close to a telephone exchange, whereas a fibre to the node network, which what Telstra was contemplating in 2005, can readily offer 50 megabits per second using VDSL, and a fibre to the premises network can offer 100 megabits per second initially and much higher speeds over time. In Japan and Korea today, there are residential services at 1 gigabit per second, which is 4,000 times faster than the 256 kilobit per second service which is sold as entry-level broadband in Australia today. Now, the issue in Australia got very complicated by the fact that shortly after Sol Trujillo arrived, Telstra proposed to the Howard government that it would build a national broadband network offering a guaranteed speed of 6 megabits per second to 98% of Australian premises. But this was subject to a condition, which is that Telstra would be freed from the regulatory requirements to offer access to its network, the access regime that both Henry and I have spoken about. The Howard government rejected that proposal, and as a consequence, Telstra came back with a new one in November 2005, under which it would build a 12 megabit per second network to 4 million premises, again conditional on legislative change, and again this offer was rejected. So you had the arrival of new technology to deliver higher speed broadband being used really in an attempt by Telstra to get out from under the existing access regime, and that has greatly complicated the public policy debate in Australia. You also saw throughout this period continuing examples of the market power of Telstra being used. So it maintained a cap on broadband speeds of 1.5 megabits per second until 2006, even though the technology could have delivered higher speeds, and it refused to introduce the next generation ADSL 2 Plus, capable of 20 megabits per second, until 2008, except in exchanges where competitors had already installed equipment to offer that same service. Now, the way, of course, that competitors went about doing that was to use a regulatory ruling called the Unconditioned Local Loop Service, otherwise known as unbundling, which lets competitors install their own electronic equipment in the exchange and then rent Telstra's copper line from the exchange to the customer's home. And I argue that unbundling was a bright spot in a landscape which otherwise struggled under the dull conformist yoke of the incumbent. And as competitors increased their unbundled lines and expanded into more and more exchanges, a growing number of customers could now receive genuine alternatives. They could choose amongst offers for higher speeds or lower prices, or they could take a product, for example, from IronNet, Naked DSL, where the customer could get broadband without having to take a $30 per month line rental service. So in all of these dimensions, competition was available and was greater as a consequence of unbundling. Even so, I refer to it as a bright spot in an otherwise grey landscape, because the most striking feature of Australia's broadband market even today is the extent to which it is dominated by Telstra. In mid-2008, the total size of the consumer broadband market was almost 6 million, and of these, 78% of services were delivered by Telstra either as a retail DSL service or they were delivered by a reseller of the Telstra DSL service. So by any standards, Telstra remained enormously dominant, and this isn't a product which did not even exist when Telstra was first exposed to competition in the early 90s. That is, it has managed to leverage its dominance in other fixed-line services into dominance in the new product, which is a powerful demonstration of, I think, one thing that most people will agree on, which is that the policy from the early 90s of seeking to achieve a competitive market in telecommunications, in fixed-line telecommunications, has fallen a long way short of its objectives. Which brings me then to the third area that I want to comment on. What then should we do? And the